Today is Monday, March 1st, 2021, and we have some problem here which I have no control over. It's already 7 minutes after nine, and the internet or the Zoom has not yet been turned on. We're trying to reach Professor Tarragon, and his number just cuts us off, so something is the matter. We don't know what, but I'll give the shear here in the classroom. I hope at some point the internet will go on. I apologize because people stay up all night to hear me in the States, and I feel very bad. I have no control over this. I'm totally innocent. I can't even say salachli ki lo chatati. But at least it'll go on yutorah.org. Following up on corrections or more information, we mentioned Rav Yaakov Kantrovich, and I received a beautiful email from my dear Talmud, Yaakov Sasson. The person who said that Rav Kantrovich was Rav Moshe Feinstein's uncle is correct. And Rav Kantrovich was also the Rav's great uncle, an uncle of Rebbetzin Pesha. The family connection is that the three sons-in-law of the Davidovich family, the Davidovitz family, were Rav Elia Pruzhana, Rav David Feinstein, father of Rav Moshe, and Rav Yaakov Kantrovich. So that's quite a family and quite Yechis. And as we said, he was Rosh Hashivim Ter Vidas, but he fell and hurt himself, and he was no longer able to commute from Trenton, where he was Rav, to New York. Very fascinating. I also want to, not so much a correction, but to add an insight. We mentioned that Rav Shmuel Brudny, later Amira Rosh Yeshiva, was a Talmud of Rav Shlomo Hyman. He was a Talmud of Rav Shlomo Hyman, not in the States, but in Ramali's yeshiva in Vilna. I thank Barry Dershowitz, who learned some Lakewood, I gather, and confirmed this with Rav Shmuel Brudny's grandson. Also, I want to mention, when I spoke about the Soloveitchik family and the name, I was quoting from Making of a Gadol. Bill Gvirtz sent me information which actually I've stated many times in class over the generations, that the word Soloveitchik means nightingale in Polish. Yomo corrected me that it also means nightingale, and not corrected, added that it also means nightingale in Russian. And the reason the Soloveitchiks had this name was because they were Levium, and the role of Levium was to sing in the Beis HaMikdash, and the nightingale is a bird that is well known for its ability to, we'll use the word sing, perhaps there's a better word when it comes to birds. Okay, regarding Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, I told the story about his second marriage, I told the story about his the student who came with a new shirt each day of the week. And I told the story, I thought it took place in Tera Vidas. The family informs me that they really think the story took place in Toronto. Before Rav Yaakov came to New York, he was teaching in Toronto, and there was a student who every day came with a fresh shirt, and his mother later becomes Rav Yaakov's wife, Bezivik Shane. I want to pick up where I left off. I'm happy there are a few students here, so I'm not just talking to the wall. But very strange, the internet, the Zoom does not pick us up. Yomo, what are you doing? That's Asaf Bednash, I see, is signing in. Now, Yomo is doing something. I'll wait another minute. If by any miracle, no, I should continue teaching. Okay. Let me pick up where I left off. Let me remind you. We were talking about Rav Shlomo Hyman, probably the most famous Rosh Yeshiva that ever taught at Tera Vidas. When Rav Shlomo Hyman was there, he was a focal personality, a central personality. Simcha Wright, I have it right?
No.
Who am I? One second.
Noah
Marlowe. Oh, but you haven't been here a long time. Okay, very, very important that I know Noah Marlowe and Simcha Brick walked in last time. Okay. It's, in BMT, I didn't let my students get away with playing games, but postgraduate, you're older than I am, smarter than I am, and bigger than I am, so I don't have much of a choice. Anyway, Rav Shlomo Hyman was a dominant personality like Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was at Yeshiva Shabbat Chochanan. The story with the criticism of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I have to add a Lubavitcher correspondent with me, Nachum Shmayahu. There always was criticism in the Litvish Welt already in Europe against Lubavitch. The sixth Rebbe, evidently, Mori?
I'm sorry, I had major problems here with my computer.
Ah, okay, wow. I started...
I apologize profusely.
Okay, you can hear me now, right?
And everything's okay.
And you're recording. Okay, so I have to tell you, I started this year, I have students in front of me, and I didn't want to... Totally.
Your meeting is being recorded.
I started this year at about 7 minutes after nine. I quoted until now some corrections. Please listen on whyutorah.org. I apologize to all that are not here. Many evidently signed out. I feel very bad, but the computer rules us and it destroys us. It's a what can I tell you? When I see the Boston Red Sox hat, I think back to Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Jay, and just think for a minute, Gips Rubin doesn't even appreciate what we're talking about, even though he grew up in the shadow of the Green Monster. Yitzchak, you know what the Green Monster is? No. All right, you'll have to look it up. It's no machlekes, it's a reality. You don't have to go to Rashi and Tosfot, just go to Boston to Fenway Park. Okay. So now I'm picking up the new material, and you can pick up what I said on whyutorah.org. So Reb Shlomo Hyman was a dominant personality. The story with the Rav, and it intrigues us. Maybe someday the article will be found. Nevertheless, I stand on Reb Nesson Kamenevsky came up in his research, and what Aaron Rakefitz showed you last week in 1942, how the Rav spoke about Lubavitch, it's very difficult to comprehend that he may have written a letter against the Sixth Rebbe. There was tension with the Rebbe already in Europe, it's well known, and the Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva in general considered Lubavitch as having gone a little bit too far in their panemius, in their, I would say, their emotional, psychological interpretations of Shas. Shas has to be taken literally, and you can very well make a case that there's no deeper meaning to Shor Sheh Nagach Et Hapara. I would say today in the year 2021, we can accept secondary explanations, as long as you realize Shor Sheh Nagach Et Hapara is the basic concept. Well, we do it with Chumash, we do it with Medrash, I don't have to tell you, we do it with Dashanut. I'm not willing to say that one is off the path because he gives a secondary, added, more emotional, psychological, spiritual explanation. But it's a fascinating question, where is the article that the Rav wrote? Before I go any further, I want to entertain you, and something I heard so many decades ago, and here we have it with Rav Nesson Kamenevsky. The story is told that people heard about what's happening, Siddisha families, heard about what's happening in Mir, it's a great yeshiva, Slabatka, and Tells already was Chutzpah Tchum, because Tells already was more modern. It had a high school, it had a girls' seminary. You don't realize that today. I remember of Shmuel Lazevolk, if you remember my talking about him last week. And I have to say, I've repeated the story all Purim, anyone, because people love it, because it says the truth. That's what I was. I have to admit it. Telz was like considered like YU today. But Slabodka Mir, and yet the students there didn't have beards, didn't have payers. The truth of the matter is that you guys in the Kollel outnumber me with your beards, and in Mir and Slabodka, you would have been looked upon askance as, afruma, afrumak, etc. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, sent spies. Of course, Hasidic families started to send their kids. You got to remember, Mir and Slabodka were hundreds and hundreds of students. What kind of yeshiva is it? And they reported back, no one has a beard, which is disturbing. In addition, they don't kiss their tzitzit during Kriyat Shema. Now, Rav Nosson says, why didn't they kiss their tzitzit during Kriyat Shema? And I want to tell you again, I've been, to me, all the years blend into one. Maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I spoke about this. And brisk, you know, I don't kiss my tzitzit during Kriyat Shema. And I tell my grandsons, absolutely don't emulate me. I saw the Rav, it's an open Gemara, you saw Rav Yochanan. But you do what everyone does. The Rav didn't kiss his tzitzit. Brisk, they didn't kiss their tzitzit. So I said, the impression I got from my world of growing up with the Rav, with Baron Lichtenstein, was, why didn't they kiss their tzitzit to a brisket? It was a primitive act. Mm-hmm. You understand the brisket? You don't know how many emails I got, people learning a pupil this way and that way, and giving me halachic reasons why you don't kiss your tzitzit and you don't have off. I couldn't believe. So Reb Nosson says, he's on my side. You know why I didn't kiss their tzitzit in Mir Slabodka? God l'tadam, Musa. It doesn't look nice that you unbutton your shirt in the middle of davening and kiss tzitzit. This is not Derech Eretz. And so now the shluchim ask the bachrim, how come you don't kiss your tzitzit? So instead of giving an honest answer, you got to remember, no one is born a tzaddik. I don't have to tell you how much has been said about this against Art Scroll. They quote Rav Yitzchak Kutner, member of Kutner, in one of his famous letters, we know about the Chafetz Chaim, no one knows how hard the Chafetz Chaim had to work on himself to become the Chafetz Chaim. No one's born a tzaddik. You have to work on yourself. Youngsters like to be sharp, like to be smart, like to tell a joke. So instead of telling the shluchim of the Lubavitcher Rebbe the truth, they said, we don't kiss our tzitzis because not all the students are wearing tzitzis and we don't want to embarrass them. So, and the Rebbe took it face value. Later, Rav Meir Shapiro, the Lublina Rebbe, again, we'll talk about him when we deal with the European yeshiva. You don't know how revolutionary this man was. It just breaks the heart. He died so young, and the building he built became the head of the Gestapo, the offices of the Gestapo. So Rav Meir Shapiro, and this I write about in Revel, he went all over the world where there were dormitories to see how the Litvashi yeshivas run, how YU, the dorm they're building. Of course, he built a dorm. I mean, this was revolutionary. So he comes to Mir, and he's watching the davening, and the same thing, they don't kiss their tzitzit. So he asks the fellas, why aren't you kissing your tzitzit? And again, they give him the same answer. Well, a few weeks later, you know, you're talking to Lublina Rav, Rav Meir Shapiro, a few weeks later, he sends a big package arrives at mir, sits it, so the mirror mashkia, Rabbi Yochum Lubavitch, said, my hi, what is this? So there was a note in there that when he visited and he was told not all the bachrim wear tzitzit, he is sure that it's because they don't have enough money. So he's sending tzitzit notes, you have an excuse. So Rabbi Yochum Lubavitch gave a whole shmuis that it's one thing to tell a joke to your friend, but to tell it to outsiders who are not going to understand, he said what you did was absolutely wrong. So it's good folklore, part of it absolutely true, that blends in with all that we're speaking about. There was tension between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, and Ein Hachinami, what went on here in Israel in the 1980s, which I lived through, it didn't begin here. Rav Shach had his viewpoints already in Sklutsk. Rabbi Aaron Cutler had these viewpoints as well. And it lives on. I can say even in YU today, some of my colleagues, Reshi Yeshiva, some of you might know that maybe 20, 15 years ago in this space medrash, I debated with some of my revered colleagues who are world famous, and they actually believed that Hasidim are apikorsim. I can still remember at Heschel Shech that Heshi telling me, Aaron, they daven shalom bisman. All right, I agree, it's not halachically correct. Halavai, we should bring them back to a halachic basis. But to say apikorsim, it hurts me, because following the Holocaust, if you do a survey, a higher percentage of people raised in the Hasidic world remain frum as compared to the Litvisha world. So it says something. I can explain that it's not for now, but there's psychological, sociological reasons why that happened. And it's not that I justify davening shalom bizman. I'm the last one in the world. You know how early I daven and mincha, mariv, I'm very makpid. But I don't say Tachman after sunset. Sometimes I daven now very close to my house, and they begin 15 minutes before. If the minyan, sometimes it has to be 13 minutes. The chazan's a little slow. They fall into sunset. But all right, don't emulate me. It's maybe I don't like to say Tachman. I have a Hasidic soul. Okay, so this is the reality. This is Reb Shlomo Hyman, and this was the world of Teira V'Das. Now, we mentioned that after Reb Shlomo Hyman, Reb Gedalia Shor, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky become the Rashi Yeshiva. I received a number of emails, and people think I don't know. I actually know more than most of you, but I don't have to say everything. When you teach Torah history, I've said many times, everything you say has to be true, but it doesn't mean everything has to be revealed. Certain things are human foibles, and you just have to go on. I don't want to embarrass Gedolei Yisrael. But here I have to be more exact today. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky came in from Toronto. He was not an American. He was not raised in Torah V'Das. He was a bit of an outsider. He came from Toronto to Brooklyn. It was a big move. Those of you who have grown up in Toronto, not everyone is happy to leave Toronto. I know today I don't know what's going on, but on a certain level, it was a nicer community than New York. It had less tension, and it's a more relaxed community, if I can put it that way. It's part of the British Empire. They sing God Save the Queen. No one in America sang God Save Trump or God Save Biden. And by the way, God should save Biden because he's an older man. And the other day, it's on YouTube. It's all over already. He stumbled and forgot what in the middle of his talk. He lost his what they call a senior moment. He lost the continuity. But Toronto's Toronto. Reb Yaakov comes to New York, and he was a very humble personality. He and Rav Aaron Cutler grew up together. Rav Aaron Cutler was hail, fire, and brimstone. Rav Yaakov was not like that. They were different personalities. Rav Yaakov had a lot of Agmas Nefesh, ultimately in Torah Vedas. I know all about it. I know this is what I got letters why I didn't mention it. There was a big machloket. I don't have to mention with whom. I think you understand. There were two Rashi Yeshiva who were in charge of the Yeshiva per se. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin already says, Dabar echad ledor, lo shnei dabarim ledor. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. You have to have one president, not two. There are exceptions, and I would love to believe that my Talmidim can handle being part of one or two or three. The greatest example is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Yehuda Amital. This is an example for all of Klal Yisrael, how to build a yeshiva and how to get along and cover that kaira and to have different points of view. It's beautiful. I repeat what Rakefet wrote about in Washington and has said a million times. No one has the shita that works perfectly. We have Satma, you have now a television series, what, unorthodox, whatever, you can, it's horrible. You have two Satma girls from the finest Satma families who converted to some form of Christianity. You can see them going to Tevila, the baptism online, it's on ye. God have mercy. So Satma, YU has turned out Sadikim, Gedolei Torah, Chassidim, Anshei Maisa, and it's turned out people who are Mechalei Shabbos, etc., etc. Lakewood, also I can give, no total success. No one has it. Lubavitch doesn't have. We have, all right, we have 90% success. It's fabulous, fabulous. But we have our problems in Israel today. I need not tell you, no one has the perfect shita. But Rashi Yeshiva, all right, Rav Aaron and Rav Yehuda Amital, wow, what an example they gave Klal Yisrael. Now, Rav Yaakov had a lot of aggravation, and I have to say that even Odd Scroll could not cover it up. You open up the volume in Odd Scroll, Rav Yaakov, I photographed it, I hope you can see it, Rav Yaakov by Yonatan Rosenblum, The Life and Times of Hagon, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov with his beautiful, beautiful smile, that's Rav Yaakov. It's a perfect picture. So even God's Scroll had to publish. In the summer of 1967, Rav Yaakov decided to step down as Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vedat. He had never thought of retiring. In general, Rav Yaakov did not believe in retirement. A person has to live with a bren in English, zest, bivrit, in cheshek. And retirement seemed too much like preparing for death. I don't have to tell you how much is being written about this today when the population is older. And in any event, Torah Vedas at that time, I'm quoting, was beset by many internal disputes. Rav Yaakov feared that the prolonged involvement with Machloikis would destroy his Midot, and he was unwilling to endanger the striving of a lifetime. And this is very important. When you get involved in Machloket, and I'll tell you what Rav Yaakov said. This was told to me. I'm hearing it. Someone who heard it directly from Rav Yaakov. I just don't want to mention the name because it doesn't add anything to our knowledge. Rav Yaakov said, I can forgive this individual for arguing with me, fighting with me, wanting more covered, etc., but I cannot forgive him for having turned me into a politician. And that's why Rav Yaakov left Torah Vedas. And there's so much truth to this, because you see politicians, take the example of Bibi Netanyahu. And I'm saying this without any prejudice. I've watched, I've been around, I'm living in Israel 52 years. We have this prime minister, what he has accomplished, it's beyond words. Who would ever dream that we're now talking in terms of a military alliance with Saudi Arabia, Dubai, the Arab Emirates, etc., etc. Look what he did with the Chislun, with all the morons who don't realize this is pikuach nefesh. My own grandson says to me, but people are losing their civil rights. It's pikuach nefesh. It's like a war. What are you talking about? You're worried about your right to go out and party and hulava? Ribbono shel olam. And with all that he's done, he's a politician. And when you get involved in politics, you do things that are terrible. And the simplest example is the last election, there was a united front of right-wingers, and look what he did with Bennett. Instead of taking him into the government and giving him a position, he put Bennett, threw him out, no power, no position. He worried that he might become too well-known. And today, that's the greatest mistake. If you follow what's going on in Israel, the greatest mistake Netanyahu made. He may very well be out because of what he did for Bennett after the next election, if they can form a government without the Likud. As you all read about, it's facts happening before our eyes. And Rabbi Yaakov, you understand, he learned in Slabodka, he learned by the Alta, he learned Musa, he learned Gatlat HaAdam, and to turn yourself into a politician. So Rabbi Yaakov retired to Muncie, he was no youngster at the time. God blessed him with another 19 years. Basically for 17 out of the 19, he functioned 100%, and it was in Muncie that he became Rav Yaakov. The whole world started turning to him. And here I just want to correct myself. It's not that he had any formal position with Beit Medrash Elyon, but many students, with many others, because now Muncie was building into a Torah community, people came from all over to consult with Rabbi Yaakov, to talk and learning with Rabbi Yaakov. And remember, Rabbi Yaakov knew how to paskin. He had learned in the Kollel Lahora'ah in Slabodka. The man was a Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva Talmud Chacham, but he had also been a Shtat Rav. He had ability in Psak, and here's where people came to Rabbi Yaakov from all over the world. Rabbi Yaakov very involved with Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. Rabbi Aaron Cutler is gone. Rabbi Yaakov becomes a focal figure. He becomes a focal figure with Torah Mesorah. And I have to say, he was one of the individuals who put Muncie on the map. You talk about Muncie, it's hard for you to understand. All you had in Muncie was a conservative temple. Who heard of Frum Jews living there? Finally, there were a few Frum Jews in Spring Valley. Spring Valley had Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, was the Rav, the son of the Rav's cousin, the son of Rav, he was the son of Rav Simcha Soloveitchik, also an Einikel, the grandson of Rav Chaim. But he was the Rav in Spring Valley. That's where the Beit Medrash Elyon began. But now Muncie became an Ir V'Em B'Yisrael. And part of it goes back to Rabbi Yaakov. Now, from that point on, Torah V'Das is going to have many fascinating faculty people. It's going to have many, among them, some very well-known people. But Torah V'Das never really had a focal personality. In other words, all the years, maybe Rav Avram Pam, when he became Rosh Yeshiva, perhaps you would say about Rav Avram Pam, he became a very focal personality. There was, we'll talk about him in a moment, there was very little, no one had a critique of Rav Avram Pam. Rav Avram Pam was a homegrown Torah V'Das individual. He came to America, before Bar Mitzvah, if I remember, I told you, but if I recall, before Bar Mitzvah. He worked on his English was absolutely perfect on a very high level. It was as if he was born and bred in the United States. Art Scroll doesn't tell you he spent a year at Yeshiva College. I told you, if not for the commute, he would have been a Yeshiva College graduate. But the commute from Brooklyn was too difficult. His father was Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, and he was beloved by all. He was a very independent personality. That was part of his attraction, that you didn't have to wear a uniform. He accepted everybody. He himself refused to wear a uniform. A Rosh Yeshiva has to go with langa begodim, with long clothes, etc. Bekesha, dress, a Prince Albert, I should say, dress properly. He wore a modern suit. He never changed. All right, the joke, you know, behind his back, they used to say, it's to please his wife. They used to say about the Rav that he was at one point clean-shaven, then afterwards had a Van Dyke. So also they used to say to please his wife. All right, could very well be, but that's part of life. But if you want the prime example of the greatness of Rav Pam, I'll tell it to you very simply. When the Lubavitcher Rebbe lost his wife, Chaya Mashka, Rav Pam went to be Menachem Avil. In Panovich, Rav Shach was furious. And that tells you who Rav Pam was. He said, I shouldn't be Menachem Avil to Lubavitcher Rebbe. I know him intimately since 1941. When he came to America. How far was Teira Vadas from 770? And Ad Kedei Kach, I shouldn't go. Rav Pam, totally, that required. You got to remember, by the early 1980s, Rav Shach was in the Litvisha world, what today Rav Chaim Kanievsky is. You follow me? The leading figure, Das Teira. And there's Teira Vidas, which is not YU, which is supposedly much more to the right. And Rav Pam, the Rosh Yeshiva, goes Lenachem Avil. And that's one little episode from Rav Pam. I can tell you many more. I knew the family very well. Some of you know his younger brother lived in my building. We were neighbors for over 40 years till he died. And you know, when he remarried, who was Masada Kedushin? A guy named Aaron Rakefet. And all Rav Pam, his brother's children were there, and everyone, and they all, Baruch Hashem, this was Rav Pam. And if you ever meet his Talmidim, they're filled with warmth, they're filled with outreach. He raised a cadre of Talmidim that reflected his saintly personality. Ein gomrim olavet the halel. He was a focal figure. He was technically Rosh Yeshiva. After him was Rabbi Yisrael Belsky. Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, he died just a few years ago. He was technically the Rosh Yeshiva. He didn't have, in other words, with Rabbi Yisrael Belsky already, there were some criticisms, I don't want to repeat, but sometimes he had to make decisions that inevitably were incorrect. I can give you one simple example, which is well known to everyone, so it falls into the category of Dabiyadu'ala Rabbim. In the Five Towns, there was a rabbi from the right-wing world, married into a very prestigious family, Rabbi Scheinberg's granddaughter, or daughter, I should say, Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, or granddaughter, I might be skipping a generation. Let me be safe. And right wing wrote this for Art Scroll, and it hurts to talk about it because I know the man. He was involved with women. I don't understand it. Again, you have a wife. The Gemara Ray Tall talks about Namora, that said about his wife, she there were negative comments about her personality, but he said she was the greatest because she saved me from sin. A woman has to be smart. A man has hormones, etc. I don't have to elaborate. There's a volume came out from Sonsino in the early 70s. It has a white cover on marriage. Beautiful advice to women in there. All right. You're married, everybody. Your wife. I can't go further. But it was a tremendous scandal. So the rabbinate came out totally against this individual. The right wing, the centrist, everyone came out. I mean, it was terrible because of a very, very important shul. And Rabbi Belsky commented, there's no clear testimony. When everyone knew the facts, there were no shnei edim bishat ma'aseh. And there was a lot of criticism. It cost Torah Vadas a lot of money. There was supposed to be a parlor meeting in Lawrence, and they canceled it. All right, I don't have to tell you. But Rabbi Belsky was very, very unique. In what respect was he unique? The man's general knowledge was unbelievable. When you study Artsko, wherever there's a question of mathematics, of astronomy, I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, when I get to mathematics, I'm the biggest amaretz in the world. The subject just turns me off. I can't explain it. And I did well in high school. I did well. I had 98, the place 96, man. The man was a genius. Artsko quotes him when they have difficult issues. Rabbi Belsky, his animals, shchita, anatomy of the animals, the man was an absolute genius, way beyond his great knowledge of Shas and Peskim. So he was Rosh Yeshiva. But again, while all these people were Rosh Yeshiva, there were others there. There was no focal personality. To put it very mildly, in YU, if the Rav said something, that was it. Ein bodkin acharei ha-mispeach. A Kohen is oved avodi, you know, the Gemara. So you don't check. He has yichus. The Rav said that was it. Rabbi Yerichon Yeravik could yell all he wants, and this one could yell all he wants, and didn't matter. The Rav spoke, zehu zeh. In Torah Vadas, it was not like that. Now, I just want to mention a few of the Rosh Yeshiva. You can, if you're fascinated, take the volume that came out. It's a beautiful volume. I don't say it's historically correct, and it's not put in context, and it's like Rabbi Revel and YU and Eitz Chaim and everything that happened before Torah Vadas didn't exist, and how they got the name Torah Vadas, Lida Yeshiva, etc. But it's a beautiful, beautiful volume. It shows Ahavas HaTorah and love of the institution. And there you'll find it's a major volume. I can barely lift it. It covers a whole desk. You'll find biographies of many of the Rosh Yeshiva. I want to mention for Rav Avram Yeshayahu Shapiro. He came from a Hasidic background. He was a big Talmud Chacham. Chassid, Litvak, all blended into one. Talmidim loved him. Why do I mention him? Who is his son-in-law? And there you have a picture in the volume of the father-in-law and son-in-law sitting together. Gentlemen, his son-in-law is your Rebbe, your posek, my chaver, Reb Heschel Shachta. What's Reb Heschel's wife's name? Shoshana. Shoshana's maiden name is Shapiro. The Rosh Yeshiva from Torah Vadas is Reb Heschel Shachta's father-in-law. Reb Moshe Wolfson is the Mashgiach in Torah Vadas, in the Beis Medrash, and also a very fascinating individual. People, if you ask the old-timers in Borough Park, they will tell you that it's Reb Moshe Wolfson who set the tone in Borough Park, built it to what it is today. In the early 70s, he organized a Beit Medrash in Borough Park. And this Beit Medrash, Emunat Yisrael, became famous not just for davening. There were endless shtibbles in Borough Park. You walked in, you walked out. This was a Beit Medrash, Limud Torah, davening, not just, I daven at a minyan, it's express trains, and God, the reading of the Megillah the other morning, a kid with a black hat, black uniform, he read the Megillah in 19 minutes. I had to do my own reading. All right, I have a klaf in front of me. I finished 3 minutes after him, trying to keep up with him. I was losing my breath. What's the big deal to read the Megillah so quickly? He hit Lahavut, davening, Borough Park, Chesed. They called him the generator that inspired the entire community. Now, before I come to today, there was one Rosh Yeshiva, and here, really, again, I plead with you fellas, go on to graduate school and do a doctorate, a proper doctorate, on Rav Moshe Dovber Rifkin. I trust you've heard the name, the ignorant should pass for the wise. He was a very fascinating individual. His years, to place him in context, 1891 to 1976. Who was he? Born in the Ukraine, where Shlomo comes from. His father was a shtetl in a city called Zimtsi in the Ukraine, Ben Sion Shurin. He came for Lubavitch stock. Now, Lubavitch organized it in the end of the 19th century, I think it was 1897 or so, they organized the first Hasidic yeshiva. Now, what do I mean by that? And I've explained this before, decades ago. Let me explain it again. In the Litvish world, Rav Chaim Volozhin evidently reached the conclusion Torah will not survive without yeshivat. We can't allow it to continue in a haphazard, desolatory fashion. What went on before? You learned in the local shul, if the Rav of the Shtut was a good Rebbe, he gave a shir. You understand, not every Rav can be a Rebbe. Not every Rebbe can be a Rav. There are different types of personalities. I have to be honest with you, when I left the yeshiva at the age of 23, my goal was to be the most famous rabbi in the United States, the president of RCA. And you have to have a personality, right? I don't say I did badly my first stellar. I was an idiot. I was a kid. I didn't know what. I got killed. I was reelected. And I think the vote was 9-7 on the Board of Trustees. But the second stellar, I did okay. I built the first Mechitza Orthodox Shul, suburban Essex County. I was there till the day I went in Aliyah. But to be a Rebbe, that's a different world. You have to have different abilities, and you have to have a different type of outlook. And there lehefech, you have to understand that humans are different, and not every, you don't want to clone students, underline the word clone, you want to inspire students. And I've told you more than once, I had a kid in BMT, maybe in this building already, it could have been in Neely before we came here, and this kid was corresponding with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and some of the faculty laughed at him. And decades later, I meet him in Los Angeles with a long beard, a chabotnik, and he's a lawyer, and he was in there on legal business, and he hugged me. He said, "You were the only Rebbe who inspired me." Doesn't mean I'm a Lubavitcher, but he needs it. I have a Tom Moshe Weider today, Coney Island. He's well known, he's the Rav, he runs the Kehillah, a Chabadnik. He's the guy that has published thousands of pages on why Aaron Rakepit is an absolute rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, hanged, toothless, depraved, degenerate, debauched, repetitious, malevolent bummy. Because he doesn't have a beard, right or wrong. He was on the front page of the New York Times. His books, remember I showed you, Rapine Kanevsky, there are his books. And he's always Makatoiva. Why? Because that's it. Because in high school, when he told me he's unhappy, I encouraged him, leave YU and go to Nei Yisrael. And he was always Makatoiva, that someone getting a paycheck from YU and a YU personality. It's not that I'm Yeruchim Good, Reb Yeruchim Gerelik against YU. Chas v'chalila. But for him, it was no good. So you need a different personality. And this Reb Moshe Dovber Rifkin was... They recognized, Reb Chaim Volozhin recognized, you can't leave it to chance anymore. He organized Volozhin. Volozhin gave birth to many of the yeshivot, as we know. The Hasidic world never had yeshivot. If you wanted to go to the Rebbe's court, people were sitting and learning. They probably were chaburot, but no formal yeshivot with a structure, with classes, etc. Lubavitch organized, this is the fifth Rebbe of Shalom Dovber, organized Yeshiva Tomchei Tamimim. That was the first Lubavitch yeshiva. And it was on a very high level. You went to mikveh in the morning. A chassid goes to mikveh every day. And the first hour of the yeshiva, you learn chassidus. Then it was a regular yeshiva. And Reb Moshe Dovber Rifkin was one of the early Talmidim, and he was a Gaon Adir, great Talmud Chacham. He was very famous, became a shamus for the Rebbe. And the fifth, and he writes his volume, first volume, he writes Ashkevad Rav, he writes about the fifth Rebbe, his final days, his death, what happened afterwards. It's a very fascinating volume. Later, the communists take over. He runs away to Jerusalem with his wife. And here he is in Yerushalayim, also involved in organizing a yeshiva with Hasidic overtones. From Yerushalayim, he travels to America, like everybody else, fundraising. Fundraising for the yeshiva in Jerusalem. And in America, Torah Vadas comes over and appoints him, asks him to remain. And he had many positions in Torah Vadas. At one point, he was the Menahel. For many, many years, he was a Magid Shir, a regular Rebbe, a Rosh Yeshiva. Later in life, he was responsible for the Smicha program at Torah Vadas. And he published a sefer, Tiferet Zion. I don't know if you've seen it. I have it. It's a big volume. His Sheurim in Torah Vadas. But what was unique about him, he was Torah Vadas, Talmud Chacham par excellence, could match up with any Litvish Resh Yeshiva, Sheyurim on a high level, very attractive to the American youngsters who were going to college and had been exposed to study and organization and concepts, and a Lubavitch Chassid, Bulev V'Nefesh. You have to read the introduction to Tiferet Zion to see what he writes about the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because you have to remember the 1970s, the Lubavitcher Rebbe already was at the peak, at the height of the mountain. Hundreds of thousands were attracted. The Fabrengens at 770, what went on, and it's on the radio, they're the first to take advantage of modern technology and phone hookups all over the world. And oh, he was enamored of the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I wanted to mention he left a beautiful family. His son-in-law was Reb Aaron ben Zion Shurin from the Shurin family. I hope you recognize the name. If your mother studied at Stern College, you can check with them. They probably had Rabbi Shurin as a teacher. He taught many, many years at Stern College. He was the one we cite. He wrote for the Yiddish papers. He published Sforim, biographies of Gedolei Yisrael, Mossad Rav Kook, a very capable individual, Ish Eshkalot, with many, many abilities. That was Rav Shurin. On his other side, his own sister was married to Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. Elka Shurin was Reb Aaron's wife. Let me mention that Reb Aaron ben Zion Shurin, his son, Harav David Shurin, and his wife Esther, when they visit Israel, they come to the Shia. You've met them before the pandemic. We had wonderful guests. Let me also mention that Rav Rifkin had two children. His daughter married to Reb Aaron ben Zion Shurin. He had a son, Shalom Shurin, who went on to become, this is a Torah V'das Musmach, and he went on to become the chief rabbi of St. Louis. He died 10 years ago. He's a member of the RCA Beit Din. He was an Adam Gadol, Rav Shalom Rifkin. What a fabulous individual, and what a wonderful wife, who was the daughter of Rav Beresh Zuckerman, who was an Austro-Hungarian, unbelievable Talmud Chacham. He was the Orthodox rabbi in upstate, in Buffalo. Maybe some of you heard the name. And they tell the story, I'm reading from Rav Shalom Rifkin's, when he died, his biography was published in St. Louis. He was born 1926, Hadassah Hospital in Yerushalayim, the second child of Russian Jews who had fled to Palestine as persecution of Jews intensified during the rise of Stalin. And when he was ordained, Reb Moshe Binyamin Tamashev, that was the Mabit, was a very famous Rav in Brooklyn, a Slutska, first great Talmud Chacham. He's the grandfather of my classmate who just died this year, Cherry Blitzstein, Rav Yaakov Blitzstein, who was professor at Be'er Sheva University. And the Mabit called Reb Shalom the most gifted of his generation. He became a Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin. Then he came to St. Louis. It was his first shtela. From St. Louis, he wound up in Seattle. Seattle and Queens, came back to Queens. Queens called to become chief rabbi of St. Louis. But what's fascinating is when he came to St. Louis the first time, while in St. Louis, people suggested meeting a young lady from Buffalo. He took the trip to Buffalo. There he went on a blind date with Paula Zuckerman, the only child of Rav Dov Beresh Zuckerman and Hinda Zuckerman. Her family had escaped Austria after it came under the control of Nazi Germany. He and Paula, who became a clinical psychologist and enlisted her husband in helping abused women, were married in 1954. So you see, Rav Rifkin, beautiful family, a magnificent individual, a man who taught at Torah V'das for many decades, but a life that combines Lubavitch, more than Lubavitch, than Yerushalayim, more than Yerushalayim, Torah V'das, had a shul in Brooklyn, and was close to the Rav. The Rav's hesped for him is one of a kind. Halavai, it should be published within the next months, I hope. or at least a few years. It has to be edited and done properly. So this gives you some feeling of Torah Shas. Nowadays, in the last 10, 20 years, there were 3 Rashi Yeshiva at Torah Vadas. With the death of Rav Belsky, they always listed Rav Belsky, Rav Reisman, and Rav Savitsky. Rav Savitsky, I believe, is a son of Rav Mordechai Savitsky of Boston, who was involved with the Rav and the Kashrut questions in the 30s and to the 40s. He was not on the Rav side, he was the opposition. And I can tell you that even though he was the opposition, I was privileged that one of the greatest Talmidim I had in the Kollel, who sat right here for many years, was his grandson, Rabbi Leib Irons of Toronto. If Leib is listening, I hope you have your doctorate already. So it's an interesting family. But Leib's uncle is one of the 3 Rashi Yeshiva at Torah Vadas. So these are well-known names in Brooklyn, in the right-wing world, in the Torah Vadas world, Rav Belsky and Rav Reisman and Rav Savitsky. With the death of Rav Belsky, Torah Vadas searched for a new Rosh Yeshiva, and that's how Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein comes to be the 3rd Rosh Yeshiva, or at this moment in time, the one that is in the limelight as the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. Now, Torah Vadas has a problem today that didn't exist 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. This problem is not just Torah Vadas's problem. Every yeshiva in America, in the right-wing world, cannot really build a Beit Midrash of quality. The reason is very simple, the state of Israel. Everyone goes to Mir. The better students wind up in Lakewood. Some go from Mir to Everyone goes to Mir. The better students wind up in Brisk. Some go from Mir to Brisk. It's a tremendous attraction. Nothing in America equals it. From Mir and Brisk, those who go back, they generally go to Lakewood. Lakewood has become an extension of Mir. What's unique about Mir? It's not really a yeshiva in the sense you have Rashi Yeshiva, focal figures. You have Chabura. You have Chabura Sheyurim in every language in Mir. English, Hebrew, Yiddish, Russian, French. I don't know what I left out. I may have left out another language. It's, you find your place. But Mir, you have to know how to learn already. You're not going to learn how to learn there. It's not like YU where you have great grades. You come in, you begin with this Rebbe, you move up. By the time you're a junior in college, I trust, you know how to learn. In Mir, you have to come in already at Talmud Chacham. Same thing with Lakewood. Lakewood, you have Rosh Yeshiva. I believe each week one of the 4 Rosh Yeshiva gives a public Shia. Not all the... By far, not all the students attend. The main learning is on your own. If there's a Chabura and someone who's really different, like Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was in Volozhin, he began giving a Chabura, but that attracts. In Mir today, Rav Ariel, they say, is the top Chabura. I think they say over 1,000 people go to hear him. But this is why they brought in Reb Yitzi Lichtenstein. If Reb Yitzchak can give something unique, you capture the limelight and you become a counterforce to Lakewood. People will think twice when they come back from Eretz Yisrael. Maybe we have something to gain from the Nin V'Neched of Reb Chaim Brisker. For as on a personal level, I absolutely hope that Reb Yitzchak conquers the Torah world. I remember him when he was a gleam in his parents' eyes, we'll put it that way. Yitzchak himself is a YU Musmach. He went to America to learn with his grandfather. but I wouldn't call him a YU person. Even when he was at YU, it was basically his grandfather with the Chabura, and by that period already, the late 70s, the early 80s, YU had shifted. And as you know, I've told the story many times, how I went to visit Rebbe in 78. I spent the Shabbos with him in Boston. And in Boston, students came up to be with him, and he pulls me aside and whispers to me, he says, this is my students of today, he says. They know how to learn, but their hashkafas? He said, I dismissed them. And unfortunately, they dismissed him hashkafa-wise. So I thought he's playing to the audience, knowing me. A year later, Reb Aaron Bat visited Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Reb Aaron was the mankal of Machon Lev at that time. Then he was the mankal of the Encyclopedia Talmudica, Talmud of the Rebbe, a little bit before me, my time, but he's a little older. So the Rav calls him aside, the same words, don't pay attention to the hashkafas, he says. But his own grandson got caught up with the other hashkafas, not the Rav's hashkafas. Gentlemen, this is as honest a picture that I can paint of the early history of Torah V'das. We took it to the 60s, the 70s. As I've said more than once, I can't go beyond it because from that point on, I'm very subjective and not objective. However, yes, Benjamin.
Rabbi Gedalia Shor was there before Rabbi Wolfson? Was he there the whole time?
Rabbi Gedalia Shor was there before Rabbi Yaakov. He grew up in Torah V'das.
So was he there with Rabbi Yaakov or not?
Don't ask too many questions. That was...
Yeah, I
thought you understood.
Yeah, I was... Yeah.
Okay. But you'll understand, Rav Gedalia Shor left children. He died young. I mean, that was the amazing thing, that Rav Yaakov, who was so much older, goes on to a whole new life. And I believe Rav Gedalia Shor died in 77. You can check it out. The volume... is Torah V'das. It's a beautiful volume. Halavai YU reads, someone should undertake to do a volume like that. We have arrived. In the 60s, as I mentioned to you, I was very close to Rav Gedalia Shor's brother-in-law. Rav Gedalia Shor's brother-in-law was Rabbi Louis Isby. His sister Shifra was Rav Gedalia Shor's Rebbetzin. Rabbi Louis Isby was a Torah V'das product who, in 1962, when YU expanded, first hall opened, they could take in more students, four new Rosh Yeshiva were appointed. One was Rabbi Dr. Noah Goldstein, Noah, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. One was Rabbi Albert, Nissen Albert, Talmud Mefukah, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, son-in-law of Rab Scheinberg, ties in with that family, right? One was Rabbi Louis Isby, who was a Rebbe in Torah V'das. And he was the Rav of the Young Israel, or what I believe it was the Young Israel, right near Einstein Medical School, Einstein Hospital. A lot of the frum doctors davened in his shul. Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Yibada l'chaim aruchim v'tovim. The fourth one was the person whose voice you now hear. Out of the four, I was close with all of them, but very close with Louis Isby. Whatever the reasons were, we hit it off. And I told you, he said to me more than once, you don't know what a pleasure it is to teach you what Rabbi Belkin did for me. You teach no politics, no machleket. You don't have to become a politician. And that's very true. YU is YU. Beautiful atmosphere. When I taught in America for YU and teaching here, same story. One day, he came and he was in tears And he said to me, you don't know who died. And he mentioned a name which I didn't even recognize, but I knew that in Torah Vadas, a young Rebbe died, a Rebbe with so much promise. Well, years later, I did more research, and that name has come up time and again. It was a tree cut down in its prime. The fruits it would have given. Talmidim loved him. And this man, you read his life story, it's a photograph of what was happening in America, in Brooklyn, 20s into the 30s, 40s. His name, Rabbi Yosef Levitan, L-E-V-I-T-A-N. Now, I want to spend the rest of the hour, 2 hours, and I want to remind everyone, please go online to pick up the first part where I spoke about emails and some corrections, and I couldn't understand, you know, why we're not on Zoom yet. I want to tell you about a volume, and I knew the author too. I have to apologize that people laugh at me because I say I knew this one. I happen to have known, God privileged me to know many, many great people. I should have been much more than I am, considering who I spoke to over my lifetime. I apologize, but at least no one can accuse me of not trying to be as good and kind and learned and knowledgeable as Ani Rothkopf / Aaron Rakefet can achieve. George Kranzler, Gershon Kranzler, did the name mean anything to you? Yomo, name mean anything to you? We spoke about the Ukraine while you were putting your breakfast together. Rabbi Rifkin was born in the Ukraine. I mentioned the city. You might have told us where it is, anywhere near Kiev, where you were born. But go, not now. Gentlemen, George Kranzler. Don't you know from YU, David Kranzler? It's a well-known, Moshe Kranzler. A well-known family. And it's very fascinating. These were original Torah Vadas families, Brooklyn families. Kranzler, Pelkowitz, you give many names. They all, their descendants, all found their place in YU. In other words, Torah Vadas of the 30s was not much different than YU of the 80s and 90s. George Kranzler, or Gershon Kranzler, I taught his daughter actually, was a Torah Vadas graduate, a wonderful individual, did a doctorate at Columbia University. And his doctorate, it's a doctorate in sociology, you can call it. It has some political science overtones, beautiful doctorate, published by Feldheim. I believe it's been published twice. I believe there are two editions. You can check it out. The doctorate is, the publication is called Williamsburg, A Jewish Community in Transition, a study of the factors and patterns of change in the organization and structure of a community in transition by George Kranzler. Okay. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehyeh Bedvaro. Now, what makes this doctorate so fascinating is that at the end there's an appendix of 4 interviews with individuals living in Brooklyn. And I've quoted from these interviews, there's some with refugees who came to America, but the one that I want to quote today begins on page 235. The life story of R.J.L. Anonymous. Took me a long time to learn that it's Rabbi Yossel Levitan. Everyone knew him as Yossel, Yosef. I can't get an exact date of birth. I more or less figured out it has to be about 1928. So if he would be alive today, he would be 9 years older than I am. Could very well be he'd be alive. It's a shame he'd be 92. At my age already, 92 is not that old. And he tells his life story. I was born 7 years ago, 27 years ago. In other words, he's telling this story I believe it's the early 50s, figure it out. I was born 27 years ago. I was the fourth child of parents who had come to the United States from the neighborhood of Slonim in Russia, Poland, in 1922. In other words, he was born when his parents were in the States 6 years. He was born in the Slonim area. I have one set of grandparents out of my four grandparents. I have one set of, I believe it was my grandmother on my father's side comes from Slonim. On my mother's side, my mother's father was from Vilna. Her mother was from Kovna. And on my father's side, his father was from the Minsk area and his mother was from the Slonim area. But all my grandparents met in America. They came as 15, 16, 17, and they met in America. My father was a tinsmith and welder who made just enough of a living to support his family. But my father passed away soon after I was born, and my mother was left with one girl and three boys, none of them old enough to go to work until years later. Obviously, our youth was not spent in luxury. But we had a pretty pleasant childhood, South 2nd Street, in the heart of the good old Williamsburg section, which has since deteriorated terribly and become inhabited by Russians, Poles, and Puerto Ricans. Okay, when he says Russians, Poles, I don't believe he means Jewish. It's not the wave of immigration of 1990. We're talking about non-Jews. But now he goes into Yiddishkeit. My parents came from a good Jewish background. But like many of their fellow immigrants, they gave up much of their Orthodox conduct while adjusting to the American life. They spoke Yiddish to us, and we replied in English. And here, you know, this is a life description. I have it in my greater family. When at the Shabbos table, we're at my children, my wife and I speak English. All right, all our granddaughters-in-law, some are of Anglo descent, speak perfect English. Some are Israelis, but they all understand English. So our deal is we speak English, they respond in Hebrew. You follow? Now, this is part of life. Now, I have to admit I'm totally fluent in Hebrew, but nevertheless, I may be psychologically more at home in English. You understand that? Particularly my wife. I always say about my wife, Malka is the only person to come in Aliyah knowing Hebrew. She's a Ramaz graduate, and to forget it over the decades here. You follow? Because who does she speak Hebrew with? All our friends are Anglos. And even the Israelis, from when we came in Aliyah, most Israelis spoke perfect English because they grew up here when it was under the British. So, they speak Yiddish. My parents knew Yiddish because their parents spoke Yiddish to them. But my parents, obviously, their native language was English. Like my sister and brothers, I attended public school and liked it very much. I belonged to the junior group of the Hashoma Hatzair, the Mizrahi organization to which my brothers introduced me. And very interesting, there was Hashoma Hadati, I should say, I think I said Hashoma Hatzair, Hashoma Hadati. Now let me give you a little bit background. In America there were two religious Zionist groups. One was Bnei Akiva, one was Hashomer Hadati. In the mid-50s, these groups merged. It was a very historic moment. You don't really appreciate it, but Hashomer Hadati had mixed dancing. What does mixed dancing mean? You dance the Hora. I saw this in Israel yet when I came in Aliyah. I once wrote a letter protesting. Boys and girls held hands during the Hora. Bnei Akiva, for whatever the reasons were, started picking up a lot of students, not just from YU, but from Chaim Berlin, Teira Vadas, and they insisted there be no mixed dancing. When Hashomer Hadati and Bnei Akiva merged, I think it was 1954, but it can be checked out, one of the conditions was there would no longer be mixed dancing. And that was a great, you know, because you can make a case, holding hands, or no, boys and girls holding hands is not like 80-year-old people holding hands. V'day l'chakima b'remiza. So he was in Hashomer Hadati, and he's a normal Jewish kid growing up in Brooklyn. I entered Jewish high school in our neighborhood and was very fortunate in getting teachers who were interested in their students. I had a gift for writing, was on the newspaper staff, and did some fine arts work. I was just about to start taking piano lessons at the insistence of my teacher when things began to happen that influenced my life radically and changed my whole perspective. Had I gone on, I would have become a good Jewish American young professional with a college career, probably like my brothers, religious, but not too orthodox. Although my leaders in the Hashomer Hadati group tried to make us interested in Palestine and in the Jewish religion. And what he's saying here is a perfect photograph of that period. Here's a kid in public school. There's a fella who's online, Steve Bressler. You don't, Ellie, you read, he came to our classes. He grew up in the Bronx. He never went to yeshiva, but he was always a Shomer Shabbos. He loved the rabbi, loved the shul. By the way, he grew up a two-minute walk from Yankee Stadium. You can't appreciate what the Bronx was like, Jerome and 161st, Grand Concourse, 161st, the Yankee Stadium. You can't appreciate how many shuls there were in that neighborhood. Rav Heschel Shaftik grew up there. His father, Rav Melech, was rabbi of one of the big kehilot there. And you didn't go, you were a Shomer Shabbos. But it, you know, it was not the intensity and the learning and all that we have developed today, a yeshiva graduate. It was a different world. What you have to give a lot of credit to these kids who were in public school and yet went to shul, appreciated the rabbi. You don't become a great lamdan. That's later in life. You come in Aliyah and you're exposed already to learning Torah every day. And you see the public school, the way he describes it, and how intelligent this young man was. Look how much he's doing. He's writing, fine arts, piano. He's what I would call an ish ha'eshkalot. But then he says, but Providence apparently wanted it differently. And I cannot imagine how I could ever have felt happy the way I did then. One day I met a young fellow on the playground who was an excellent baseball player. But curiously enough, he kept wearing a skull cap, and occasionally his tzitzit were hanging out of his pants. And you see, he's on the playground, every kid is playing ball, and here's a kid with a kippah. Who played ball with a kippah? I mean, you can be a frum person, you take off the yarmulke, you're playing ball, you don't want it to fall off, or Ribbono Shel Olam, it's not the din d'oraita that you have to wear a yarmulke. His name was Moish. He was a fine and quiet spoken boy who told me all about an organization to which he belonged and the Jewish school called the yeshiva, which he attended and which he loved very much. He kept on urging me to come to the meetings of the organization called the Tzirei Agudat Israel, the boy groups of which are called Pirchei Agudat Israel. I promised him I would go with him at least one time. And here you have it, the chance meeting with this kid on the playfield. His name is Moshe, and he tells him, come, he's attracted. It's a Jewish kid. He sees a kid, sits at kippah, wants to find out more. Pirchei Agudat Yisrael. All right. Could very well be that this Moshe is Mike Tress. We'll talk about Mike Tress. Let me look back at my own life. I want to pay homage to Rav Henoch Fishman. I'm dedicating the article I just finished. It's more than an article. It's I have to see how I'll publish it. And we'll take care of everything. We'll be punishing them in due course. It's being set now into a computer program, and then we'll worry further. So I'm dedicating it in memory of Rav Henoch Fishman. And I'll tell it to you very simply. You look at a decision you make in life. I wanted to go to Bronx High School of Science. I was accepted. You have any idea in the 55 Bronx High School of Science? It's not like being accepted to Harvard, okay? And Reb Henoch said to me that Feishness, Eben Daf Gains, Rank Science, and Daf Learning Gemara, man. You're not ready to go to Bronx Science. You should learn more Gemara. So I said, but Rebbe, the exams, everything is ended for TA. No, it's June already. He said, I'll take care of it for you. Be interviewed. See, and as they say, the rest is history. He arranged the interview with TA. I write about it in Washington, what happened at the interview with the Rashi. And just think where you would have been had you gone to Bronx Science. I would have been a Frum Jew, I'm pretty sure. I hope so. But Ribbono Shel Olam, how much Torah I have studied, how much Torah I have forgotten. I'll tell you a good vat from the Rebbe. I told this to someone, he kissed me, he was so excited. It's a good vat from the Rebbe. Because we learn Torah, we all forget. The Rebbe complained too. We don't have Aaron Lichtenstein had a memory that's unbelievable. None of us had a memory like Rebbe Aaron. But we learn. If I would tell you how much I've learned over my life and the Svarim, etc. But the Rav said it's like going to mikveh. Eli goes to mikveh, you come out, you dry yourself off. Where's the water? Yes, you dry yourself off, but the tahara remains. The purity, the enhancement, the endowment. You learn Torah, that... that remains with you. It's the purity. So you see this kid, take a look. He would have been just a normal American Jewish kid. He says his sister, his brothers are religious. Shemesh Shabbos. It's a big achievement in America. All right, but they're in Brooklyn. Williamsburg already was different by this time. But just think, what he became by this chance meeting with the baseball player, with the kippah, and his tzitzis in dreisen, sticking out of his pants. All right, we'll pick up here later. It's a very moving story, a very beautiful portrait of the era. I wonder what became of the Levitan family, not his family, his family. Also, I wonder, did he have children when he died? His wife later remarries. Now, she married the very, became a very chashuva. She married into the Beren family of Denver, the big Bezivik Sheni. She married Sheldon Beren of Denver. These were the tremendous Balei Tzedaka. One part of the family gives to YU, and one part gives more to the right of YU. They won't give to YU, they give more to the right of YU. So, but I'm curious, with his sister and brothers, be interesting to know where we're at with the great-grandchildren and great-grandchildren of today. So if I can reiterate, Morty, I apologize. I imagine you were very tense. Wow. All right. I hope it straightens out and we won't have the problem again. Yomo was trying to call you and your phone was not answering. We were like in the netherworld. Either way, we couldn't understand what was happening.
I was busy trying to make it work. I didn't have time to talk.
But it works now?
Yeah, that's why I sent out what I sent out. For next week, it'll be okay.
Okay, good. Okay, of course, until Pesach, we'll stay with one shir. I have other problems now. The Eibush, the Lesnisht, I need an implant and a root canal. And I have the best people in the world, my nephew and the son of my friend, of my people I know for 90 years. But they're so busy that they'll first get to me in 2 weeks. Baruch Hashem. I'm told that the implant and root canal, the way it's done today, it's not the way it was years ago. Baruch Hashem, a lot of progress was made. So to reiterate, we followed up in Torah Vedas, and I want to talk about the Yossel Levitan. You'll see his life story, his insight, some of the things he reveals, and his Talmidim who revered him. And Nebuch, he passed away a young man. I don't believe he was 40 yet. I also want to mention, and this is for Nachum Lam and others, the Svarim blog had a big article on Rav Gerelik, the Rav, and revision by admission. It's worth looking it up and reading it. Let me state 2 points that are absolutely correct and solve all problems. One, in relation to the Lange case, the brother and sister who were suspected of Mamzeret, I trust you all know that I published a great deal about this in Rakafat Aaron Chelek Gimel. You can look it up. I lectured in the Kollel for many months on the topic. I may be an Amaretz, but this is a topic where you cannot tell me anything. Baruch Hashem. I am fluent. Let me tell you, Zahom Machlekes in the Svarim blog, what was the Rebbe's opinion? I asked Manny, Rabbi Holzer, Rabbi Emanuel Holzer, no one was closer to the Rebbe at that point than Manny Holzer. And I said to Manny, Rav Gorin is right. Manny said to me, the Rav absolutely agrees with Rav Gorin. Underlined the word absolutely. One of the bloggers wrote that in, that the Rav said if the facts as Rav Gorin found them are correct, it is child's play that he's absolutely right. The Rav didn't come out in public supporting Rav Gorin. There are reasons why. But he agreed with him in theory 100%. I can only tell you, if you've heard my subsequent lectures, if you look into Rav Ovadia's posthumous volume of Yabia Omer, I spoke about this in class, if you look into later volumes of Rav Moshe, what they were matir in Mamzeret makes the Lange case look like child's play. So please, don't debate the issue. The fact that the Rav said Mamzeret, he's speaking when there's real Mamzeret, there's no way you can resolve it. But here, Baruch Hashem, what Rav Gorin uncovered with the social workers in Tel Aviv, the reports of the 1930s, Rav Gorin 100% correct. It's one of the great tragedies that politics caused such an attack upon Rav Gorin. It is a black mark for Torah, love of Torah, honesty, gemilut chesed, love of human beings. We have a lot to do tshuva for. And I can tell you it's like the pandemic. Who would ever dream that from Jews would risk their lives and other lives and laugh at the police and the instruction? It breaks the heart. And don't tell me the Chilonim Tel Aviv. Chilonim Tel Aviv have no Torah, have no Yirat Shemayim, have no Shulchan Aruch, have no Rabbonim, don't know what Yiddishkeit is about. They're wonderful Israelis, but they have a lot more to learn to be Jews, and we have an obligation to teach them. But don't tell me Tel Aviv. Tell me Meir Sharim, tell me B'nai Brak. I'm concerned with my own, who should know better. The Lange case hurt. A lot of people never got over it, myself included. I knew many of the judges, by the way, who agreed with Rav Gorin. One of them I was quite close to, Rav Avram Shapiro's nephew, Rav Lezer Shapiro, Zichronim Sadikim Levracha. The other thing, they raised the issue, I tell you, you laugh how people have no knowledge. They raised the issue, they found Rav Gorin's wedding album online, and there was separate seating. Of course there was separate seating. Rav Gorin had gestampfen Chassidim. His father and mother were among the founders of Kvar Chassidim. Check it out. Chassidim sat separately. But the Litvisher in Europe, I asked my Rebbeim 100 years ago, they said to me, family seating. That's the way they justify the mixed seating. So please, don't bring a proof from Rav Gorin's wedding to the Litvisher Welt or the world that we're in. I'll show you something else very interesting. This is the invitation to Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's wedding. We take pleasure in inviting you to celebrate with us the marriage of our children, Tovra and Aaron. The wedding will take place on Tuesday evening, December 22nd, 1959, etc., etc. 6 o'clock in the Dorothy Quincy suite of the John Hancock Building with the address signed Joseph and Tanya Soloveitchik, Yechiel and Bluma Lichtenstein, November 1959. A beautiful invitation. So you'll find this in the archives. There's only one trouble. This wedding never took place on that date. My wife looked at it. She said, they got married in 1906. Correct. Lo aleinu, the Rub was very ill. And that was when he had the big operation. And the wedding had to be postponed. So anyone who got this invitation got a second card that told them about the postponement. And this is the problem with archives. When you find this, you figured for sure this is factual. I had the same thing. I found the manuscript of a talk that Rabbi Dr. Heschel Revel gave about his father in Baltimore right after it at the Shleshim, January 1941. A very important manuscript because what was crossed out, I got rid of the crossing out and I found what was underneath and I cited in my doctorate. It proves that Rabbi Revel was involved with the Bund and went to jail in Russia, as I write about in the Revel era. In Bernard Revel, I shouldn't say Revel era, that's the era. It's Bernard Revel, Bild of American Jewish Orthodoxy. There's only one problem. I later learned that Hesped was never given. It snowed and Baltimore was snowed out. They had to cancel it. So as far as I know, it was written out but was never given. But those are the archives, and there's not much you can do with it. Finally, you have to have mazel to find where the archive may be incorrect. Finally, I just want to mention that in Jerusalem Report, January 25th, 2021, it's a publication here, very left, I'm not happy with it at times, you know, pluralism, intermarriage, assimilation, Torah is Torah, and we're sure we're pluralistic, Hasidim, Mitnagdim, etc. Anyway, my dear Talmud from BMT, the early years, David Jablinowitz, although he used an Israeli name when he was on the radio, there used to be David Zev was the name. I would hear him on the radio. Now there's no more English radio as far as I know of. Anyway, he wrote a beautiful story, bus stories, stories about buses in Israel. And he tells the following story, that he was on this bus every so often, the exact bus, because he got out of work and he would catch this bus. And every so often I'd encounter a Haredi, ultra-Orthodox yeshiva student and a seemingly secular IDF soldier who would sit next to each other on the bus. In the first meeting between the two that I witnessed, the yeshiva student and soldier were arguing over what provided greater protection to the country, learning Torah or serving in the military. During the course of their subsequent meetings on bus rides, the conversation turned to a greater understanding of each other. Ultimately, I boarded the bus one day to find the soldier wearing a kippah and learning Talmud with the yeshiva student, but also having enough time to brief the Haredi student about the options for serving in the IDF. And that's a beautiful little story which should be our goal. Another story he tells that I spoke about in class when it happened, it's a year ago, during the first lockdown, he was driving to Yerushalayim to bring food for his mother. I know his mother, I know his sister, I know the family. The mother is of American origins, the father is Israeli. And he was stopped by a policeman on the highway from Beit Shemesh to Yerushalayim. And he explained that he was bringing food to his mother in Jerusalem. She's older, and for Shabbos and Sunday, bringing her food. And the policeman said, "Wait here," went to the police car, and took out a bouquet of flowers and said, "Give this to your mother too and wish her a good Shabbos and good health from Rafi, the policeman." And that's a beautiful story. And I want to tell one more story. It's going to be hard for me to get through this story, but I'll try. And David, if anyone knows David Jablunowitz or David Zev, tell him this story, because he's collecting stories on buses, travel on a bus stories. This is a true story. It was headlines maybe when I 69 or 70, when I first came in Aliyah. And the story is as follows. People were waiting for a bus at Shlom Tzion HaMalka. A lot of buses come there, a little bit up from the King David. And this Jew is waiting there, and this bus comes, approaches, and the bus driver signals him, don't get on the bus. Guy sits down again. 10 minutes later, the same bus line, and the driver signals him, come. So someone was watching this, caught the same Jew a week later, and he says to him, explain to me, my high, why, same bus line, what's the difference? Why did you wait an extra 10 minutes? He said, I'm a survivor. I will vow I don't want to ever have any benefit from the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. I've been taking this bus line, I work 30 years now. The drivers all know me. I will not get on a German-made bus. The first driver signaled me, not for you. It's made in Germany. The second driver signaled me, this bus was put together in Israel. You can get on. And that's another bus story with a deep message. And finally, just in Yom of the Purim, so I hear people say, oh, this Megillah reading, I know the story of Purim. Why do I have to hear it again? And I have to tell you, there's no more important story than the story of Purim. Excuse me. We should read it every day, not just on Purim. You know why? Laharig lahashmid labein minoshim v'ataf. No one can believe this. We're living in a world. Look at Bernie Sanders. Look what the man said in public. Look what the jokes they're telling on prime TV time in America. No one can believe this, that people... This was our greatest tragedy, that we didn't read Megillat Esther every day in the 1930s. There was Hitler, there was Germany, and what were we doing? And I don't have to go any further than to quote the Rav when asked about demonstrating. I now have additional proof that my memory is correct. Other people have quoted the Rav. We were asleep when the Nazis rose to power. We didn't protest, we didn't yell, we didn't plan. We didn't take it seriously. No one could believe that Lahamid, Laharog, Lahashbed, Lahashmid, Minav, Ataf, women, men, children, what they did to us. Halavai, we read Megillat Esther not just once a year, but every day. My dear students, thank you very much for honoring me with your presence. Are there any questions in the classroom in front of me? I see you're enjoying the fallout of Purim, the big cake in front of you. Am I right? Enjoy.
Chocolate,
what's it called?
It's called a chocolate bomb.
A chocolate bomb.
Put it in the hot tub, and you pour hot milk, and it becomes hot chocolate, apparently.
Looks great to me.
But
I want to tell you, I would make a rule for Purim, only give Shalach Manet kosher lePesach. V'hamevin yavin. Now, it's even worse. Next Shabbos, I'm going to be together with a good part of my family. We're all going away together. And it's a third of the family, from one daughter with all the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, Kanayin Hara. And I can't even give them anything because everyone has so much surplus. They look at me, no, we don't need, we don't want, etc. Morty, open it if there are any questions from the wonderful students all over the world, from Brian Thor on. Yes, any questions? Morty, anyone hearing me?
The recording has stopped.
Yeah.
Rebbe, I shared the story with David Jablonowicz. He was very appreciative.
Ah, kol hakavod. So you know why...
Yeah, we grew up together in Sheepshead Bay.
One second. Mark Lich, you reached him already in Israel. Kol hakavod. Okay, so...
He was right a few houses away from me.
Tell him I said hello.
Okay. But by the way, Mark, tell him I know the original story with the policeman has... It's a little different than I told it. But I told it the way I did so it would be logical. But explain that to him. He'll understand.
I'll tell him.
Yes. Okay. Next.
Rebbe, just one thing. You said about Rav Pam and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I remember that at the Rav's memorial at YU, he was there were the Feinstein brothers, and he was the only other Gedolim, whatever you want to call it.
Right. Yeah. Right. No.
Rebbe.
Yeah.
I remember. Okay. Hear me? Okay. I remember the Rav saying in Shir that Reb Chaim didn't kiss the tzitzis because he felt it was a distraction.
A distraction. All right. I used the word a primitive action, and in Mir it's described already that it's not mechubedik to open up your shirt in the middle of davening. But I'll never forget when I mentioned it years ago, I got pilpulim, with sauces that if the tzitzis and all four of them have to be, Ribbono Shel Olam, we're all saying the same thing. Halacha L'maisa, it's very important that every kid should kiss his tzitzit today. It's I can't do it because I'm from a different generation. But let the kids kiss and have tzitzit and value tzitzit and understand tzitzit. And remember, Yesel Levitan saw this kid, Moish, with his tzitzit out on the baseball field. Yes, Brian.
You mentioned about Bronx High School of Science, so I just want to give you a little history. My father and mother are both graduates of Bronx High School of Science, which makes that an important thing is that originally Bronx High School of Science was for only boys. And my mom was in the first class of graduates, of women, to graduate. My sister went to Akiba Academy, which was the precursor for Salonika Real Academy.
Academy.
The school, when it was merging, was not really doing as well as my parents wanted it to do in terms of the secular education. And my sister went to public school, where she went to the Real Jewish Center Hebrew School and became from there, and then went to Bronx High School of Science, which goes back to your story about, you know, people being in the public school and still remaining from. My sister was the first graduate of Bronx School of Science to have both parents that graduated there. I was unfortunately not one of those. I got into Bronx School of Science, but I told my parents that I wanted to go to Ramaz instead. Actually, I wanted to go to Yeshiva instead, and they insisted I go to Ramaz instead. They said, if you're going to go to a place, you have to go to Ramaz. It's the best. I wanted to go to MTA or MHS, whatever it was. So I broke the pattern. My whole family went to Bronx School of Science. We're all from the Bronx. We're from Cedric Avenue and from Kingsbridge Heights, University Heights.
Right, that's where Riverdale was. Riverdale, Sar Academy represents Salanta Akiva Riverdale. And believe me, it bears little resemblance to Salanta as I knew it. But we'll leave that for another time. Brian, where does your sister live today?
My sister lives in Manhattan. She's an eye doctor. She was the first Orthodox woman president of the American Optometric Association, following my father's footsteps, who was also an eye doctor. She's a member of KJ, and her kids will go to Ramaz, went to Ramaz. Baruch Hashem, a family that's very connected to KJ.
Very nice, very nice. My brother is an eye doctor, is an ophthalmologist, and the person who will do the implant is my student and my nephew, the stories of Israel are unbelievable. He was in medical school, Zev, Dr. Zev, my nephew. He was in medical school at Hebrew U, and he found out there was an opening in the dental school, and he switched. Why did he switch? Because in Israel, dentists make a better living than doctors. That was his chishuv. You know, you tell it to people, they look at you, but kachave. Yes, David Twesky.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, you're talking about people had an influence on sending people to yeshiva who would have been on another course. Rabbi Shalom Rifkin of Seattle had that influence on me.
Wow.
And he was a rabbi there in the late 50s, early 60s. And they didn't have a Gemara class for me, so he lived with me personally.
Wow.
And when I came to YU, I was in Rabbi Parnas Ashir, and he said, he wrote the first report card to the parents, I'm going to have to recommend public school to all incoming day school yeshiva classmates because of his background.
Wow.
But anyway, I wanted to tell the story of Rabbi Rifkin when he was... went to St. Louis the first time. He was, as you say, single. And he went to Lubavitcher Rebbe for a bracha. The Lubavitcher Rebbe must have been just starting as the Rebbe there in the early 50s. He gave him a bracha, you should someday become the Rav of Rosh Chi in St. Louis.
Wow.
So he was St. Louis there about 10 years. He came to Seattle another 10 years. He was in Parakway for 10 years. And then when Rabbi Achenstein was nifter in St. Louis,
right,
one of the only cities... That's Rabbi Shia. He was got in that position.
Right, right.
Did he ever appointed anyone after?
Okay.
What's doing today in St. Louis? I don't think there's a focal chief rabbi. It was the Vod Ha'ir, and the Vod probably still exists. I know in St. Louis, I can tell you one story. I was scholar in residence a number of years ago, And Saturday night, everyone goes to this terrific ice cream place to get ice cream. And the place, what's the story? So they told me the story. It's Italians who had a secret to gelato. The Italians are famous. They came to St. Louis. They're selling ice cream. And never the Jews can't go near there because it's not kosher. And everyone is raving about the ice cream. They make Ben and Jerry's look like pedestrians. Finally, this Italian guy has heart trouble. And the two doctors who saved his life at the big hospital in St. Louis, he doesn't know what to do for them. And he says, what can I do to repay you? And they say to him, we're Orthodox Jews, make the gelato kosher. He said, absolutely, how do I make it kosher? They said, we'll send you a rabbi. The OU came in, the rabbi came in, and all their ice cream is kosher. And Saturday night, Kadesha Yasa, everyone is lined up, and let me tell you, it was good ice cream. My dear students, I'm being told the room is needed. Until we meet again in health and happiness, I thank you so for bearing with me today. Das Vitania. Thank you.
How did you like
me? I can't... I can't believe he got it from America to Jablinowicz within minutes. Rabbi, thank you.
Can we hear more about Rabbi Shore and off recording?
Yeah, that was the Machlokes.
Rabbi Shore.
Rabbi Gedalia felt he was Torah Vadas. He grew up there. And Rabbi Yaakov, they looked upon, you know, an outsider who was bounced in. And it was tremendous machlokes.
Rabbi Shore was Rosh Yeshiva or Mashkiach?
No, he was a Rosh Yeshiva.
I thought when Rosh Yeshiva was there, he always wanted a Hasidish to Mashkiach.
Well, no. He developed Hasidish overtones. But he was considered the Rosh Yeshiva with Rav. Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was, you got to remember, Rabbi Yaakov was not that famous yet. The fame takes place
in Muncie.
Rabbi Yaakov becomes identified as the Rav, the most famous Rav in Muncie. You follow? The Hasidic world, they looked, the square was nearby, now Sapa is nearby. But Rabbi Yaakov was Rabbi Yaakov. And people came to him from all over. Rabbi Yaakov also, you have to remember, was very down to earth. Very normal. He'd never get involved. For instance, girls riding bicycles. He saw nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. You follow? He was very normal, very down to earth. It's mind-boggling how Muncie developed. Ultimately, the modern Orthodox YU crowd pulls out of Muncie. Very little is left today.
My in-laws live there, so.
Yeah, your in-laws, where are they living today?
In Wesley Hills.
In where?
Wesley Hills.
And Leslie Hill is more open, you say?
Yeah, they go to Innisfil. They go to Ray Jacobson's school. Uh-huh. So the school's dying, so.
Interesting.
The modern Orthodox community is really is doing well there. It's more yeshivish than the...
Wow.
Wait, so who took over for Rabbi Yaakov again in Muncie after he passed away?
What'd you say? Can you clearly...
Who took over for Rabbi Yaakov in Muncie after?
I don't
think... Didn't we mention someone was there before or after?
I don't... Berra Wine became a very... But no one, Berra Wine is Berra Wine. I don't want to, he's a great individual, but it's not Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov is a Velt Gong.
But no one took over that yeshiva?
I don't know if he had a yeshiva. No, he didn't have a yeshiva. People came to see him. He spoke. He gave shurim. You invited him. Does anyone want this? This is a little Tehillim that given to me, Shalach Malach, but I can't even see the words.